This is Fresh Air. Language is one of the main things that separates humans from animals. Many linguists are certain that human language is part of human biology, even though no one has yet found a gene or an organ responsible for language. Steven Pinker is an expert on language and the mind. He directs the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at MIT. He's written a new book about how the mind creates language called The Language Instinct.
The explanation for the logic of language, for how it works as it does, and for how people manage to speak and understand language so naturally, comes from our biological constitution, from the way that the genes put our brain together during development. The fact that languages are built out of nouns and verbs and phrases and so on isn't something that each child has to relearn, and it isn't something that had to be invented at a certain point in history and then transmitted from generation to generation. But that part of the language is something that the child is, in a sense, born with and uses to learn the particular nuances of his or her own language, that is, English or Japanese.
Each language, whether it's English or Chinese or a Native American language, each language is so different phonetically and structurally from each other. If there's like an innate instinct for language, how come there's so many different structures and sounds in the languages of different cultures?
Well, if you look a bit below the surface languages, they're actually built out of the same stuff. So even though obviously the sound of a Native American language strikes the ear as very different from English, I mean, you can't understand a word of it, but if you play it in a spectrogram, if you look at the principles that speakers of, say, Native American languages use to put words together, they're not that different from the ones that you see in English or Yiddish or any other language. So no language, for example, uses Donald Duck noises or scraping teeth. All languages combine a universal inventory of gestures and just pick different ones from this universal inventory and combine them. So part of it is that they're not languages aren't that different to begin with. The difference is why there isn't just one language, why evolution didn't just go all the way and give us all Esperanto in the genes instead of having these 4,000 or 5,000 languages, is a bit of a mystery. My hunch is that it's because no two people are genetically identical, and the whole point of language is to be able to communicate with other people. If I had a language that was 100% innate, and so did you, over a number of generations, because of mutation and genetic recombination, the languages would fall out of register. And it may be that part of the ability to speak is the ability to synchronize our language with the language of everyone else in the community. That's what children would do when they learn to speak, and that this flexibility was built in to keep everyone in sync.
What do you think is the most convincing evidence that there is an innate instinct for language?
I don't know if there would be one smoking gun, but I think there are lots of bits that add up to the same conclusion. One of them would be the fact that language is universal, and in fact, complex language is universal, and complex language of the same kind is universal. So no matter what remote highland tribe you visit on the planet, they will always have language. There you will not have any kind of primitive or Stone Age language. There's no such thing. The language of people with Stone Age technology is often fantastically grammatically complex, more complex in many ways than the European languages that we hold in such high regard, like English and French and Latin. The languages will always be built out of the same elements of case and agreement and nouns and verbs and subjects and objects. The fact that children universally seem to pick up language very quickly and without much, without anything in the way of lessons. I think almost any parent will be struck by the fact that for months their child will just be saying things like "all gone outside" or "more juice," and then within a few months, the kid is talking in fantastically fluent, complex grammatical sentences, and so that a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old can actually be arguing with a parent over what to do next in a form of speech that both sides can share.
Why is it so much easier for children to learn new languages than for adults? I mean, a child, if he's or she is exposed to it, can pick up, I think, several languages, where if, when an adult moves to a different country, it's so difficult for that adult to learn the language of their new country.
Absolutely. Again, no one really knows, but there's a strong hunch. We know that children's brains are different from adults. A two-year-old's brain actually has 50% more connections between brain cells than an adult's brain, and a child's brain uses 50% more energy. So that the brains are literally working harder and have more connections, and there's a strong hunch that that means that there's more room to register the information about a particular language. Our brains really do sort of solidify and fossilize as we get older. No one knows for sure that that's why it's easier for kids than for adults, but it's a good hunch.
Are scientists looking for a gene that controls language?
They're looking at a possible genetic basis for language, which is a first step in looking for a gene. Language therapists have often noticed that there are kids of normal intelligence, normal hearing, normal social skills, who just fail to develop language on schedule. At an age at which normal children have been talking for years, there are some kids who are still struggling to get words out, and often they struggle throughout life. They're not stupid. They're not autistic, they're not retarded, they just seem to have problems with language. And people who treat these children also note that it runs in families, that if a child has this language impairment, there's a good chance that there might be a brother or a father or an aunt who also has it. And so that leads you to suspect that there might be some genetic basis. I think it's been fairly well established that there is some genetic component to it. Where the genes are is something that no one knows, but it may be possible to find out in the next 10 years.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Steven Pinker, author of the new book, The Language Instinct, How the Mind Creates Language. He also directs the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at MIT. Back after this break, this is Fresh Air. Back with Steven Pinker, author of the new book, The Language Instinct. I know when I was young, my school teachers used to make the argument that fuzzy language, fuzzy speaking, leads to fuzzy thinking, and I've actually believed that to some extent. And you say that that's not really true. That in fact we don't think in language; we think in something else.
Yeah, I don't think we think in language. I think, surprisingly enough, for someone who spends most of his life studying language, I think language is kind of overrated. I think that we think in a number of different media. I think we think in images. I think we think in abstract propositions, and that what language is a way of converting thoughts into noises so that other people can listen to those noises and figure out what we're thinking. But I don't think that language is the thought itself. One of the reasons is that everyone knows that there can be some slippage between what you mean and what you say. You might have trouble expressing your thoughts and know that you're having trouble expressing your thoughts, or a sentence might come out and you might think, darn, that wasn't exactly what I meant to say. Let me try again. We also know that words can have more than one meaning. So when there's a newspaper headline like Stud Tires Out, which meant to notify people that stud tires had been banned, but can also be interpreted as saying that a masculine individual is fatigued.
A sex machine is puckered out.
A sex machine is puckered out. Then obviously their stud has two meanings, as does tires. Now, just saying that there are two meanings implies that there have to be these things called meanings that are not the same as words. Yeah. Similarly, when something can be a good translation or a bad translation, what does that mean? It means it conveys the meaning well or not well. That just implies that there has to be something called a meaning corresponding to a thought that's not the same as the actual noises that we make with our mouths or scratch marks we make with a pen.
I have always been told that Eskimos have either dozens or hundreds of words for the idea of snow. And I think this is always used to communicate that in different cultures you can tell a culture's values by the words that culture uses, by the language it uses. And since snow is so important to the northern native, there's dozens or hundreds of words to describe its variations. You say that this is really not true at all, that there aren't dozens or hundreds of words for snow up north.
Right. It's one of these legends that gets exaggerated in each retelling. So it's true that the Eskimos have a few words for snow, and an anthropologist noted this at the turn of the century. I think he said that there were 4 words for snow in a particular Eskimo language. And then when that was repeated, it was 7, and then that got repeated to 12, and then to 25, and then to 50, and then to 400, and so on. And I think the reason is the one that you mentioned. Everyone needs an example to make the point that different cultures have different vocabularies. And it would, sure would be nice if the Eskimos had 400 words for snow, because that would make the point so well. Just like the fact that lemmings actually don't hurl themselves over cliffs and commit suicide. But it's kind of a shame, because we need a metaphor for a headlong rush really into foolishness. And if they didn't, how could we refer to it? But no, Eskimos, this is when an anthropologist named Laura Martin really recently looked into the problem. She picked up a dictionary of, in one particular Eskimo language, and she found that there were 2 words for snow. Now, she did a bit more research, and she found you could, depending on how broad or narrow you define a word for snow, like is blizzard a word for snow, you could come up with maybe a dozen, perhaps as many as 20 in various Eskimo languages. But, of course, by the same standards, English has about a dozen words for snow. We've got hard pack and slush and sleet and blizzard and dusting and so on. It's just a factoid that was invented to make the point instead of the point coming from the fact.
Boy, I bet there's a lot of disappointed people out there.
Yeah, I've already heard from disappointed weather people, for starters.
So does the point no longer exist? Does this annihilate the point?
No, the point is surely true, but in a sense, it's kind of a boring point. I'm sure that the technician in the next booth has lots more words for bits of radio equipment than I do, and I've got more, since I like to ride bicycles, I know obscure words for various bicycle parts. And so on. When you think about it, when you forget the Eskimos, I mean, the Eskimos are exotic. They live up north in the igloos, and that seems to give an air of profundity to this observation. But when you think about it, it's really no surprise. Anyone in any area of expertise has more words than someone not in that area of expertise, and that surely is a valid point. I think the Eskimos just make it a little more exotic.
I'm wondering if you've read either of Donna Williams' books. She's an autistic woman who has this incredible gift for language in spite of her autism.
I haven't read that book, although I've heard about it, and it sounds fascinating. And there are a number of syndromes in which language and the rest of the mind can fall out of sync, which is in itself interesting because it shows that language isn't just intelligence, that they are slightly different things. In certain kinds of retardation and certain kinds of brain damage, you can get people who are highly articulate, who can sound like the most sophisticated announcer on the BBC, but score 50 on an IQ test that is in the severely retarded range. In Alzheimer's disease, if people have had experience with family members who have Alzheimer's, might notice that despite the fact that memory is completely gone and a sense of where you are or of how the world works seems to have vanished, often Alzheimer's disease patients can speak in quite grammatical, fluent sentences. So it suggests that the brain has a number of separate circuits, some of them involved heavily in language, some of them involved in memory and everyday reasoning, and it's not just one big meatloaf.
Are there like 1 or 2 questions you're just dying to find out the answers to, and you hope to find them out through your research?
I would love to find out if there are genes that that help build language abilities in the brain. I would love to find out where exactly in the brain those language abilities are. I would also like to find the universal grammar that underlies all human languages, something that linguists are now groping towards but haven't yet found.
Steven Pinker, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Steven Pinker is the author of The Language Instinct. He directs the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at MIT.